Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush said the United States would not tolerate a nuclear North Korea, and North Korea went nuclear. After it tested an atomic device last week, Washington said no more, and now North Korea is believed very likely to be preparing a second test soon. The Security Council has spoken. Sanctions have been announced, but the North Korean nuclear threat remains very much unresolved. Now, Condoleezza Rice is on the road in Tokyo and headed for Seoul and Beijing, but it is not clear that Seoul and Beijing share Washington's fervor. And Pyongyang is talking war. Up next on Point, inside the unresolved North Korean nuclear crisis. We will hear in this hour from Seoul and Washington, but first we head to China, cited by many as the key player in dealing with North Korea. I'm joined now from Shanghai by Gordon Fairclough, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Gordon, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So Condoleezza Rice is on her way. Next stop is Seoul, then China, Beijing. Will China give the Secretary of State from Washington the ironclad support on sanctions that she wants?
Well, they certainly will publicly, at least. I think, though, you see here in China and also in South Korea a lot of concerns that for these capitals actually trump the concern of nuclear proliferation in North Korea and make them a bit reluctant to put the squeeze too tightly on Pyongyang.
What's more important for Beijing than the threat of a nuclear neighbor in North Korea and potentially a nuclear arms race in Northeast Asia?
Well, those are certainly threatening prospects, which they view as a bit more long-term than the prospect of a collapse of the regime of Kim Jong-il and the potential for chaos, civil war, refugees, and massive economic dislocation if the regime there is displaced.
Does that mean that Beijing is prepared to accept, tolerate a nuclear weapons-armed Pyongyang, North Korea?
I think they probably are in the short term. As you point out, the big risk to China from a nuclear-armed North Korea is that it might prompt an arms race in the region, and most specifically, it might prompt Japan to increase its military strength and perhaps even go nuclear itself, which would reset the balance here quite dramatically and is certainly not something that Beijing wants. However, in the near term, a nuclear North Korea and a Japan that remains restrained by the United States, I think Chinese officials see gives them some breathing room to perhaps coax North Korea into a bit more of a soft landing.
In the meantime, intelligence officials are saying there may be a second nuclear test. It may be imminent. Let's look at the sanctions on the first one here. China voted for these at the UN Security Council, and that includes monitoring of all North Korean cargo by road, by air, by ship. What's going on there now? Is China really going to fulfill that sanction obligation?
I expect that they will. Much of the trade between China and North Korea, and China is by far North Korea's largest trading partner. But much of what goes across the border really is food and consumer goods, the kinds of things that would not be affected by the sanctions, also fuel oil, that kind of thing. China is not a major, weapons supplier to the North, which is the main target of the sanctions, as well as foreign luxury goods, which may transit China but aren't supplied by China. And China has certainly been making a good show in recent days of inspecting trucks at the border and they may well apply the letter of the sanctions law.
But the question is, the nuclear tests we're told are real. The nuclear weapons North Korea is supposed to have at this point, we're told, are real. But are these sanctions for real? I mean, we've seen the television images of Chinese guards at the border looking at trucks. But China has said, high officials have said, they won't look at sea traffic, cargo ships headed for North Korea, not to mention air traffic. I don't know who would do that or where. If they don't, for example, just look at ships. If they don't inspect ships, what's going to stop anything, really?
Well, that is a very serious issue. The Chinese are very reluctant, certainly, to talk about these things. China has in the past has prevented planes from North Korea flying in one instance to Iran from crossing its airspace. I think we're more likely to see that kind of behavior, that China would essentially close its airspace to overflights by North Korean aircraft. And probably an effort by China to kind of punt that problem over to the United States Navy and the Japanese Navy in terms of stopping ships.
Is it then possible, or does that mean that the sanctions are kind of a joke? If ships are coming in and out unexpected, if planes are just detouring around China, is this UN commitment to look for weapons of mass destruction or elements coming in and out of North Korea just words?
I don't think it necessarily is, Tom. I think that certainly the U.S. Navy has a lot more capability in this respect than any of the regional navies. The U.S. and both the Japanese Navy and Coast Guard have conducted proliferation security initiative exercises, boarding and searching exercises for ships. The real question is going to be, frankly, whether anybody, the U.S. Or another country, wants to risk the consequences of actually stopping a North Korean ship. North Korea has warned that it would consider that an act of war, they do have means of retaliation at their disposal. They could lob artillery shells into Seoul. They could do any number of things.
Pretty massive means of retaliation.
They do have massive means of retaliation. They might not exercise all of that, but the U.S. and every other country is going to have a major decision to take as to whether they are going, how aggressively they're going to police this, and how willing they are to risk provoking North Korea.
Gordon, if China is going to pick and choose on the sanctions, what is Beijing's long-term view here? Are they prepared to accept a nuclear-armed North Korea for some period? Do they expect the regime there ultimately to fall and become less hostile? Because if nukes are there for the long term, it's hard to imagine the region won't go more widely nuclear. What's the long-term game plan?
I think the Chinese long-term view, and it's from their point of view and probably any point of view, really a best-case scenario, is that China will proceed down the same kind of economic reform and opening path that China has, that over time the regime will, if not change its ways. And that down the road, after some kind of, a peace accord and security guarantees and all these kinds of things that diplomats have tried to work out in negotiations up to this point, if that kind of package can eventually be put into place, that then North Korea can be persuaded to give up its weapons. And I think that is still the China's kind of greatest hope here. The biggest immediate fear for China is that if they apply the amount of economic pressure they could, which would be substantial, they could turn off their oil taps, they could stop food going across the border. And that would certainly bring the North Korean military to a grinding halt. Over time, North Korea can't even fly its airplanes without Chinese jet fuel. But that could precipitate a pretty stunning collapse in North Korea, and China and the region really just aren't ready to clean up that mess right now.
A pretty intricate dance here at the moment with very high stakes. Gordon Fairclough with the Wall Street Journal in Shanghai. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to turn now to Seoul, South Korea. David Kang joins us there. He's a Korea specialist at Tufts, co-author of Nuclear North Korea, a debate on engagement strategies. He's in Korea discussing the current crisis with government officials and academics there. David Kang, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Welcome.
What is the mood there, Professor Kang? Is South Korea, on an all hands on deck footing? Are they calm about the nuclear developments in the North? What's the mood?
The mood is basically business as usual. Obviously, a lot of people are talking about it. The newspapers are full of discussion about what's going on in North Korea, but people on the street aren't paying a whole lot of attention to that.
What does that mean? Condoleezza Rice is certainly making a lot of noise about North Korean nukes. South Korea is right across the border. What does it mean that there's not more alarm?
Well, the first thing I think it means is that South Koreans have been through this for decades, crisis after crisis. And so this is hardly the first one, and it probably won't be the last one. So in many ways, they're very used to dealing with this.
Does that mean that Condoleezza Rice may not find the readiness to get tough on sanctions that she wants to get from Seoul when she arrives there tomorrow?
Yeah, in fact, the country is fairly evenly divided. Public opinion polls show that some 40-45% blame the U.S. for provoking the North. 35-40% blame North Korea for being dangerous. The South Koreans are the ones that are stuck in the middle. And so they really have a much different perspective on the sort of costs and benefits of just putting pressure on North Korea.
David Kang, in very simple terms here, we heard from China, from Shanghai just now, the view that China is not likely to do the aggressive monitoring of cargo in and out of North Korea, at least at sea and probably air, that the UN Security Council sanctions call for. Will South Korea participate in aggressive monitoring here or not?
It's relatively unlikely. Seoul has been resisting joining the Proliferation Security Initiative, which is the stopping of the ships and looking at them. The pressure is on them to begin to join these types of activities, and they probably will have to. But even the opposition party is talking about engagement with reciprocity as opposed to coercion. And so most people think that South Korea will go along sort of grudgingly with the sanctions for a while, but it'll be 12, 18 months and it'll be back to normal.
It's hard to make these views from China and South Korea line up with what we're hearing out of Washington. What does South Korea expect here long term? Are they prepared to just live with a nuclear North Korea? Do they think it's just got to be that way? Or do they think Kim Jong-il and his regime are going somewhere so they can wait out this nuclear threat?
Well, I think that the overall perspective is that and I think the previous discussion said this, is that the cost of a war or a rapid regime change are, drastically high, sky high. And so that the South Koreans are looking for a way in which they can get slow change in North Korea without precipitating literally millions of refugees, hundreds of thousands of unemployed North Koreans wandering around the streets of Seoul. And they see that as a sort of engagement broadly defined.
Is war or a collapse with millions of refugees, are those seen as real possibilities?
Not right now, which is why there isn't that much concern in Seoul. They've lived with the threat of war for 60 years. One guy I was talking to today called it, this is probably the way that people in Berlin felt during the Cold War. Highly tense, but you just sort of learn to live with that fact. So they don't see it as imminent.
David Kang, I wonder if Washington and Seoul and Beijing are involved in different realities here. Washington has its eye on Iran and the potential for it to develop nukes and for nuclear proliferation globally. The interests you're describing from Seoul that we heard earlier from Beijing are much more local, like right next door. Is Washington on the same page with these, ally in South Korea's case and big power in China's case or not?
Well, the way that I would characterize it is similar to that, which is that U.S. concerns are global, first and foremost, and they're concerned about North Korean strength, which is their potential nuclear and missile programs. South Korea and China's concerns are much more regional, and they're as concerned about North Korean weakness, and there we talk about the collapse, refugees, economic problems, as they are strength. And so, yeah, the interests of the countries are actually very different.
David Kang in Seoul, South Korea, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Jonathan Pollack from the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He's a specialist on East Asian political and strategic affairs, been on the Korean Peninsula many times, a professor of Asian and Pacific Studies at the Naval War College. His latest book is Korea, the East Asian Pivot. Jonathan Pollack, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So how do you see what Condoleezza Rice is up against here? We're not hearing in these reports the same fervor or determination, aggressiveness from China and South Korea, at least as we're hearing it, as she seems to be describing. What does that mean for U.S. strategy in dealing with the North Korean nuclear threat?
Well, I think at one level, there's no question but that both the South Koreans and the Chinese have to a certain extent recalibrated their strategies. This is inevitable in the aftermath of the nuclear test, and it would be even more manifest if North Korea were to proceed with additional tests. That doesn't mean that either is prepared to rethink in a profound way their larger strategy and interest toward the North, because as both Gordon Fairclough and David Kang have emphasized, that the Chinese and the South Koreans think of this much more in both crisis avoidance terms and longer-term transition terms. And very frankly, this is going to be the big issue now that Secretary of State Rice is in the region. We are very seized by the reality of the nuclear weapons test in the North. We are doubly concerned about any possible transfer or leakage of materials. But I think that the Chinese and the South Koreans may just define the problem in very different terms.
Does that mean then? I mean, first, President Bush set the sort of goalposts here at North Korea going nuclear, so we would not accept that. Last week, he moved that and said, we won't accept any export of this stuff. Of course, that counts on monitoring. Now, if China is not going to really seriously monitor and South Korea is not going to seriously monitor, does it mean that the whole export proliferation scenario is in play here potentially?
Well, this presumes, of course, that North Korea has a design in mind that they would be exporting it. I'm not saying that we should in any sense take at face value their statements. The North Korean Foreign Ministry, in a very authoritative pronouncement yesterday, reiterated that they do not have any intention or plan or design to export these technologies. It doesn't mean you accept that reality. It does seem to me that very prudent steps need to be taken. But frankly, for the Chinese, for example, the bulk of their interactions are pretty straight commercial interactions, some beginnings of investment in the North and so forth, in particular factories and facilities. Of course, you could argue it's precisely in that kind of a routine environment, if you're not monitoring things, that things might get in and out. But the question, frankly, is whether North Korea grasps that the United States does indeed have a red line. The red line was not the test. The red line clearly was any export, any transfer of these materials out of North Korea, wherever they might go. And I think President Bush was quite explicit about that. If that's credible enough, it may be that the North Koreans, mindful of the consequences for themselves, will in fact not go down that path. Might be the good news, if you will. The bad news might be that it still leaves in place some kind of a notional nuclear weapons capability that could develop further in the years to come. So it's more than just simply the question of proliferation. It's the question of transition now that you've had North Korea's explicit breakout from non-nuclear status.
And let me just ask about that. The president was explicit, but of course that's rhetoric. We've been reminded in the last week that North Korea has exported every weapon it's ever developed thus far. In practical terms, we heard from China that the Beijing is not likely to really monitor cargo, that will be left to the U.S. Navy and Japan. Very practically, can the U.S. Navy and Japan, can they, will they, board sea traffic in and out of North Korea?
Well, this is, of course, a hypothetical. Recognize that there are also problematic legal grounds. I mean, if people have visions here of another Cuban Missile Crisis, I hate to disappoint them. But
you say it's hypothetical, and I don't understand that. They've done these tests. That's for real. The UN sanctions are very clear, saying all this will be monitored. It doesn't sound hypothetical.
But you're raising the possibility, if I understood your question correctly, are you suggesting that we will attempt to board North Korean ships on the high seas?
Well, how else do you aggressively monitor North Korean cargo?
The way you do it, if it requires the active concurrence of other partners, is that the best way to do it is in ports. That is to say, if a ship transits from a North Korean port to another location, in essence, the local authorities have much more say over it then. But if you're talking about seizures on the high seas, that is in a state of hostilities or near-term or the presumption of hostilities. Even the Japanese have been very explicit about this in recent days, though they are trying to vigorously pursue a whole range of policies here against the North. The Japanese are also acknowledging that the latitude they have is not open-ended, and they, are for one, are not talking about a very maritime-heavy strategy here. For that matter, neither is the United States. The U.S. is emphasizing the key here, in its view, is where are the principal means of transit for North Korean goods, where are the risks the highest. To be sure, in the past, North Korea has both transferred some of its weapons technology, its missiles and so forth, by ships. But we're trying to find ways to put more heat on the Chinese and the South Koreans, because the belief would be they are the ones who fundamentally could, if you will, tighten the screws on the North.
Sounds like passing the hot potato to me here. We heard China's not eager to do this. And for that matter, a ship can steam out of North Korea and go directly anywhere in the world. So it doesn't sound like tight monitoring. I mean, they can sail straight to Iran.
Well, you know, again, obviously we conduct very substantial surveillance of what goes in and out of North Korean ports. It may be also that the North Koreans are looking for active ways to circumvent these procedures. And I should say, by the way, they've never made any bones about the fact that they export missiles. They claim they're not a signatory to any agreement that constrains them from doing this. They regard it, you know, ironically enough, almost as regular commerce. Now, we've inhibited it in a variety of ways. I don't think the amount of those transactions has been up. If anything, it has been down in recent years. But, you know, there's a separate story here that we really haven't addressed, and that would be the question of what is the ultimate intent of the policy. The suspicion in various quarters, both in Seoul and in Beijing, is that the U.S. intent is not only to inhibit and hopefully prevent any kind of leakage of dangerous materials, as well as any kinds of means of delivery, but that more generally to constrict North Korea, to isolate North Korea, as well as contain it in ways that might ultimately trigger some kind of more fundamental upheaval in the system. Now, that's a view that you hear widely expressed in some Chinese and South Korean quarters, and both of them would obviously like to have a very, very different kind of government in place in the North. The question is how you go about that. How are the new sanctions and other kinds of policies, how can they be used as a means to an end to make clear to North Korea that there is a cost to be paid for what it has done, but not do it to such an extent that it would preclude restraints on North Korean behavior and might even trigger a much, much larger conflict.
David Kang in Seoul, we're hearing lots of levels of this being addressed here. Bottom line, unclear, at least to me, do you feel in Seoul an expectation of this fundamental upheaval at some point down the road, goodbye to the North Korean regime as we've known it, or not?
Well, I think that's the underlying assumption, that at some point the North Korean regime will go away. And that's one of the reasons that, as Jonathan pointed out, that Seoul is looking for ways to actually do that under some kind of conditions where they might have some kind of control over what goes on. No one expects that to happen very soon, though.
None of this sounds exactly like what we're hearing voiced from Condoleezza Rice. Although she has said that the U.S. has no desire to escalate this crisis, then it seems high enough in a way from the get-go. David Kang in Seoul, South Korea, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to turn to Washington, and another voice, Michael O'Hanlon, joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Kurt Campbell of the just-published book Hard Power, The New Politics of National Security. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We've got a tough message, at least it sounds that way, out of Washington, but we're hearing much softer tones from our correspondents actually in Northeast Asia. Are U.S. interests and strategy aligning with those of its partners in addressing this crisis with North Korea?
Well, more than I would have guessed. I think I have to start by saying that, that the North Korean nuclear test really did receive a bad welcome in Beijing and Seoul. They don't want to push too far. I think we've been hearing that today, and you've been bringing that out. They don't want regime collapse. They don't even want the plausible possibility of regime collapse, but they do want to send North Korea a message. This is enough of this nonsense. It's a bit ironic that it took this long. You know, building 10 nuclear weapons after withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, I think, is an even worse thing than testing a nuclear weapon. And so what happened in 03, 04 should have been challenged at the time. But at least we're starting to see the other five members of the six-party process, everyone except North Korea, agree that some kind of a strong message needs to be sent. But as you point out, China, Seoul, and others may want to see it more as a message than as an actual act of harm to North Korea. And that's going to limit, I think, in the first order, the effectiveness in all likelihood. A second North Korean nuclear test, if it happens, maybe will strengthen the coalition more and lead to some real enforcement here. But I think China and South Korea are going to want to see this primarily as sending a message. And that begs the question of how do we strengthen the coalition so we can take stronger action in the future if that's what's necessary.
Though the tests are here now. Let's take a call from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Nelson's on the line. Hi, Nelson. You're on the air.
Yeah. A question and a statement. I guess I'll start with this first.
Yeah.
I think that as a just a regular average citizen, I think that I feel that this administration has let us down. I personally am not looking forward to another 50 years of a Cold War situation like we used to have with Russia. I actually like going into movie theaters and not seeing anything that has to do with James Bond against Russia or United States against Russia. I feel like this is going to turn into a Korean thing, and I don't understand why people are thinking that this regime is going to go away when they've been there since the end of the Korean War.
So what would you like to see Washington doing?
Personally, I would have liked to see Washington go after North Korea more aggressively at the beginning of this administration than now. I personally don't like this administration, but I would have had so much more respect for this administration if they had gone on to take on what I perceive to be a more realistic threat than Iraq ever would be.
Nelson, let us pick that up. Our time is short before the break. Michael O'Hanlon, what grades are you giving the Bush administration on how this has been handled? They certainly turned away from the Clinton strategy, and now here we are with a nuclear test and maybe another coming. How do you assess it?
They've had a good last 10 days, but that's about the first good 10 days I think they've had in 6 years. I think it's been, and let me try to be fair, I think their overall Asia policy has been pretty good. Relations with Japan are quite good. Relations with China are good. They've obviously improved relations with India a great deal. The problems with Russia are not really Mr. Bush's fault. Indonesia relations are at least starting to get better. Generally speaking, in Asia, there's been more of a successful track record for this administration than commonly perceived about other parts of the world. But Korea and the Korean Peninsula, these are the big exceptions.
We're joined from Washington by Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, co-author of the just-published book Hard Power, The New Politics of National Security. Got some hard situation right here with North Korea. We're also joined from Newport, Rhode Island and the Naval War College by Jonathan Pollock, specialist there on East Asian political and strategic affairs. William's calling from Bolton, Vermont. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, I think everyone, the commentators have been using the words Seoul will do such and such, and North Korea will do such and such. And in this case, it's not applicable. Countries don't make decisions. People make decisions. And here we're dealing with KCI. And we have mismanaged his psychology.
You're talking about KCI? You're talking about Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea's psychology? Or?
Absolutely. We have mismanaged his psychology over the years. His motivation is very clear. Stay in power. Retain his perks. That's his primary motivation. And what we have done is make him nervous. He was hiding. He was thinking we were sending cruise missiles after him.
So you're saying back off, even when the nuclear tests are going on?
I'm talking about how we've developed him and how and what we have to do now. How we should have developed our relationship with him was to give him firm carrots and restrictions, but also clearly signal to him, more clearly than just in mild rhetoric, and certainly not calling him an axis of evil.
Let's look at that balance and the road ahead. Michael O'Hanlon, you're giving fair marks here, but we've got a nuclear test. Our caller says we're not handling the guy at the top of North Korea correctly, and now we've got nukes there. What do you see as the interest and circumstances of the ruling regime in Pyongyang? Are they desperate? They got hungry people there? Are they afraid? Are they bold?
First of all, I give bad marks to the Bush administration on Korea policy. Okay marks for the regional policy, but bad marks on Korea. Secondly, I agree with much of what the caller is suggesting, that we have to set up a more clear system of inducements and potential coercive measures that are credible. I think what the Clinton administration did very well in 1994, especially with Bill Perry and Jimmy Carter, respectively threatening sticks and offering carrots, was to create this sort of incentive structure. I'm not suggesting it's always going to work, but it's what you have to try. Even if the North Koreans refuse, and I think we should be trying to convince them to reform the way Vietnam has reformed. So go beyond the nuclear issue. That has to be part of it. But try to get them to cut their conventional military, reduce the size of their defense budget, open up their economy, even improve their human rights over time, with the Vietnam model as what we are aspiring to, and promise some American help if they're prepared to do that. Now, if they're not prepared to do that, we can then go to China and South Korea, and which do, I think, act as governments, not just as individuals, and say to them, we have given engagement a try. It's failed. Your soft policy has to be modified to give the North Koreans the clear message that their current trajectory is unacceptable. If they change, we will then be generous ourselves. But until they change, you have to now join us in a tougher approach. So try to get all the big players to join in a basic carrot and stick strategy. It's the right way to go. It's what we argue in our book, Hard Power. On that point, I agree very much with the caller.
Jonathan Pollock, that all sounds like a strategy that's going to take time to unfold. Can the U.S. live with a nuclear-armed North Korea in the interim? How long might that be?
I would be reluctant to put a time dimension on it, only to say what would the alternatives be if you want to be, quote-unquote, rid of North Korean nuclear weapons. Michael O'Hanlon is correct. You've got to have a degree of involvement and a more intense involvement, not just simply the visit of Secretary of State Rice, however useful and important that may be to the various capitals, and I understand now she will go to Moscow as well. That's important, but it is not in any sense sufficient. It has to be a kind of sustained attention. If you expect to be able to align regional forces in a way that benefits an American strategy. On the other hand, it is going to be at least as important for us to be listening to these regional partners. It's simply not a case of where they're going to roll over and just accommodate naturally to whatever the American strategy is. I can't emphasize enough, when you look at China and how they look at North Korea, what you see in North Korea today is an echo of the China that we knew 40 or more years ago, when the Chinese detonated a nuclear weapon in 1964, when they declared they would never engage in first use, they would not transfer, they were besieged and so forth and so on, they were isolated internationally. All of that was true. All of that is at least as true now with the North. And I don't want to say to put an equivalent status here, but, you know, if Kim Jong-il's goal in part, as one of your questioners said, is to stay in power, in an ironic way, if the attention that he gets, even from afar, may validate him.
But are you saying China is therefore sympathetic to North Korea? I thought they were sincerely upset.
The Chinese are hugely upset. They are offended deeply by the fact that Kim has chosen to defy them. But they are not letting that, at least at this point, lead to some kind of a fundamental long-term break. They have too many other interests. They are too aware of the fact that there is no good option. There is certainly no good military option for thinking about this. And they're still looking at a political strategy, recognizing that they are dealing with a very, very problematic leader, but that they nonetheless see possibilities over time of internal change in the North, but they're not going to push it and rush it unless the North Koreans engage in behavior that is so egregious that there is simply no alternative to it.
Well, we're already at nuclear tests, but it sounds like Beijing is driving this bus, not Washington. Dale is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Dale. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a simple comment, which is that peace is usually cheaper economically than war. And I wonder if there's not some economic ways that we could align our interests with those of South Korea and China. In particular, if what I seem to be hearing is that there's a concern on their part of all the refugees and the instability, I wonder if we could make some economic guarantees in some creative ways to help out with those problems. That's something that would be better for the people of North Korea if we said, okay, well, so you want to, if you want to leave, you can leave, and we'll help with job training or whatever it takes to help to integrate them into the Chinese and the South Korean society. So money can solve the problem.
Right, a pretty massive challenge if it really came. The 23 million North Koreans, and if we really had an exodus of refugees, it could be overwhelming. But Michael Hanlon, what about the economic piece of this? So far, I mean, South Korea is still very much engaged with North Korea economically. Is there, do you see that Vietnam reform path that you're describing actually happening? Does it have to happen peacefully? If it comes to a crisis, a regime change, can Washington step up and kind of foot the bill for that? Can anyone afford that?
Well, first, I would welcome regime change, and I think the difficulties of refugee flows and so forth would be preferable in under most scenarios I can think of, at least, as long as nuclear weapons don't get in the wrong hands in the process, to what's going on now in North Korea. But I think we don't know how to make regime change happen, and Chinese and South Korean friends don't like it when we talk as if we do, because we use a lot of blustery rhetoric and then don't have the tools to back up that rhetoric. And if they're not going to help us, for the reasons you just mentioned, Tom, we're not going to be able to be successful, because the money's coming in from China and South Korea, not from the United States. So if anybody's going to squeeze, it's going to have to be China, South Korea, and to a lesser extent, Japan. Now, Japan is doing the squeezing, but the other two countries really aren't. And as was mentioned earlier, these fairly modest restrictions on trade and luxury goods and WMD technologies may have some effect on the North Korean elite, but they are not going to be affecting the bulk of what's going in and out from China and South Korea. So I think you need to set up the possibility of convincing China and South Korea to curb, not eliminate, but to reduce their economic engagement. There are a couple of things going on now, investment zones, free enterprise zones, very limited, very fledgling, but the South Koreans and Chinese are trying to make these work. They should be conditional upon better North Korean behavior. And then we should be willing to help North Korea make some other additional reforms and give them development assistance and approve World Bank loans and so forth if North Korea then takes further steps towards the kind of Vietnam model I'm proposing.
But do you see the likelihood of that sitting out there? I mean, I don't see, I haven't heard of China and South Korea backing off their economic engagement much yet. If the WMD and luxury goods sanctions are as kind of ephemeral light as they sound, where is the stick here?
Well, I hope the luxury goods piece will have at least a little bite. So I'm not going to.
Why is that so important? Less caviar for the ruling class. Does that really matter?
Yeah, because I think your caller from New England was correct a few minutes ago in saying that's what Kim Jong-il cares about. If he can buy off the top elite and maintain his own lifestyle, and he stays in power and he stays...
So it's power,
Yeah, I think power and lifestyle. I mean, Kim Jong-il is a playboy, and he's a decadent playboy and loves money as much as most dictators have historically. So that does have some potential, but I think you're going to have to envision getting at the couple billion a year in flows from South Korea and China and making North Korea worry that those could be vulnerable to reduction if current behavior trends continue and if they don't denuclearize. So that's what I think we have to that's why we have to work towards a common strategy of carrot and stick. I agree it's going to be very hard to pull off at this point. We're 3 years late on developing this and implementing it, but better late than never.
Let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, good to talk to y'all. I'm just an average working blue-collar person. I'm not an academic, but...
Good to have you. What do you see?
Well, what really frustrates me, I drive a truck for a living, and I listen to the news pretty regular, and I'm old enough to remember the Korean War, and I'm old enough to remember that the Americans basically kicked the Koreans' butts all the way back to wherever they wanted to, and if MacArthur had had his way, there wouldn't be a North Korea. But because we didn't want to upset Russia, we allowed for the demarcation line to be established. And so since that time, during that most of the war, we weren't fighting the North Korea.
It was a pretty tough fight before we got back up there. But what do you think should happen now out of all that, David?
Well, this is a Chinese dog and pony show. This is all this is. This whole North Korea thing is a Chinese dog and pony show. And it's a diversion from real problems that we have in this country, which is that the American economy has its collective manhood in the Chinese pocketbook. And that's just a working man paying taxes, tired of seeing a bunch of BS being pumped into economies don't appreciate it.
David, we've got it. We got the perspective. Let us pick that up. Jonathan Pollack, well, a couple things here. First of all, the real Chinese agenda, if it's a Chinese dog and pony show, I mean, we've heard recently that what China really wants, it's been put out there, is to eventually have a very friendly regime in the north, kind of like their own Tibet. And that their real interest here is in working this whole crisis so that it ends up with a friendly, not a competing nation across that border. How do you see China's long-term interest?
Well, I think the Tibet analogy is not a very good one. Tibet is part of the People's Republic of China, whether people like that or not. But they are looking, the Chinese, in North Korea for a regime that will undergo a transition. They're frustrated, but they also, very frankly, know that although in theory you could argue that they could just cut off oil, cut off food, and in effect, get the North Koreans therefore to submit. But they're very cautionary about this. I mean, our estimates of how easy these things are to do may not at all comport with the way they see it. I think it's important, and David just made a relevant observation. North Korea is America's longest running adversary. Mm. We have never had a normal relationship with the North from the very day that the regime was founded in 1948. That's, of course, what the North Koreans call attention to all the time. They want to be legitimated. They want to be validated. They want to be compensated. They want assurances that our intentions are not malign. All of that requires a level of involvement that is frankly not, I don't think, where the Bush administration really wants to proceed, because it's labored effort, it's diligent effort. Mm. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. We hold out that possibility to the North Koreans if they will yield all these capabilities that they have, but the North Koreans and Kim Jong-il, from their perspective, say, look, this is the only card we have to play, because at the end of the day, it's North Korea's capacity to inflict harm on its neighbors and to do other things that are deemed exceedingly dangerous to international security that are the only real card they have to play. So if that's the only real card you have to play, you're going to be very, very careful about how and when you yield it. Mm. And that's the dilemma that we face.
I'm not hearing a resolution here yet. Let's get one more call from Washington. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm kind of following up, I think, on a question the fellow from Lexington, Mass. asked.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm thinking if the problem is China's and South Korea's regional concerns about the breakdown of North Korea, what would be the possibility of something like an internationally funded Marshall Plan, something like we did with Europe? And of course, it's come up a lot with Iraq, but that's a very different situation.
Our time is short. Let us pick it up. Michael O'Hanlon, is it possible to sort of love this problem to death, to drown it in money? Marshall Plan.
Well, it could be a piece of it. But, of course, Kim Jong-il is not going to be persuaded by a plan that would have him leave power and then rebuild his country into something more like a Western democracy. So we have to get to the point where the North Koreans are somehow willing to have this happen. And what that basically means is that Kim Jong-il has been overthrown by his own people or by outside military action, the latter of which is totally unappealing because of the nuclear threat, the artillery threat, and so forth, and the former of which seems quite unlikely, and I don't think we have much influence over. So I have no problems with talking about that, and I think it would be fine to do it would be appropriate to do. And the South Koreans know full well they would, by the way, pay most of the bill, mm-hmm. despite the call to the international community. Japan would help a fair amount, mm-hmm. And we would too. But the bottom line is you can't get there through any obvious policy mechanism, and so it remains a hope, not a plan.
Our time is very short. The war threat, Pyongyang, of course, they always talk in very inflammatory terms, but they've talked about war, declaration of war in the UN sanctions in the last few days. Do you see a real war threat on the Korean Peninsula?
Yes, but not because the North Koreans are going to back up this latest language. The real war threat is if the North Koreans push the nuclear issue further, if they either decide to try to sell some technology or build a lot more weapons, complete the big reactors they were working on in the early 90s, we decide to destroy those preemptively, then they retaliate. That's the way in which a war could happen. I don't see any other deliberate way in which a major war would be started with open eyes by one party or the other.
And in 30 seconds, it sounds like this is not going to be solved overnight. What about the proliferation threat? How high? How serious? Out of North Korea.
Less than a 10% chance that North Korea would transfer plutonium, but unfortunately a lot more than 0%.
Tough stuff, and we appreciate the perspective from each of you. Michael O'Hanlon in Washington at the Brookings Institute, co-author of the new Hard Power, The New Politics of National Security. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
And Jonathan Pollack at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. It's been great having you with us this hour. Thank you so much for your time and thoughts.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jonathan Pollack, Naval War College. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.